Welcome to Rhea Radio, episode 115 with Alex Camacho. It's about time.
What up, my deal makers?
You're listening to Rhea Radio, the nationally trusted name in real estate investing. We dig deep to discover investors' why in real estate. If you want to skip all the BS and get in investors' heads, you're in the right spot. Be one of the thousands to check out RhiaRadio.com. You know, technically, Owen, this is the second time we've had Alex on the podcast.
Yeah, so we had Alex on in at BPCon. We kind of caught him coming out of the auditorium and got a little short interview with him, learned a little bit more about his business and where he operates. So that was a lot of fun. We've had your name up on the board of guests we'd love to have in for a hot minute here, about a year and a couple of months. So this has been a long time coming, man. We're looking forward to it.
me too, guys. It's always a pleasure to appear and to share my story and to anything that we can glean from all the action and all the trials and tribulations we have as investors. I'm always happy to chat.
Yeah. Now we talked a little bit before we hit record here. You had speaking of challenges, you had earlier this year, when was this? You got hacked. You have an Instagram account that's really, you do a great job with content creation on there. I'm a follower. I love your stuff, but yeah, you kind of went dark there for a little bit. I was like, I don't know what's going on, but what happened this year?
So yeah, and well, it was in 2023. We were just in the first part of 2024 now. But I woke up one morning in March of 2023, and my account was hacked. I could not log in. I have a social media manager. She didn't know what was going on, and we looked around. We reached out to Instagram, and it just kept on going week after week after week. You know, I called a couple of my high level friends, and you know, it's something that's actually very common. When people sometimes are, you know, are haters or people are, you're getting a lot of these fake accounts. And so apparently they found a way to get me hacked for impersonation. I found this out later. So it was either one of those fake accounts or somebody that did it maliciously. And I contracted one company to help me with that. I mean, there's individuals and, you know, companies out there can help get it retrieved. And I paid them $5,500 to do it. It was a huge fee, but I generate so much business and deals and capital and talented people come work for me. All of the above through my Instagram. Been very active for about 4 years now. And you can see I have like over 1,000 posts. So I'm quite active. And so it was a huge hit because, you know, I didn't have a voice as far as that social media platform, our main one, was concerned for quite some time. That company was not successful. They did refund my money. And then I went through another company. They also were unsuccessful. And then the third company I went through, this was already kind of going into like month four or five, not having it. After about a month not having it, I had already started a backup account and started using that and grew that organically as well. But it was frustrating because I had close to 20,000 followers. And then, yeah, I mean, it was just down. And I was really at the brink of just giving up and just asking for that third refund from that company. And then they retrieved it. So it was 6 months down without using that account. A lot of people thought, yeah, I just went like dark or I just disappeared. I did have a lot of people reach out to me and were like, hey man, what's going on? Are you okay? Like, you know, that had my number and you know, friends and contacts and told them what's up. And I thought it was going to be a lot easier. I mean, I went through the process, like you're sending your identification over, proving like, hey, this is me. I don't know who's talking about I'm impersonating somebody when this is like my account, this is my information. And he finally was able to get it retrieved, man. But it was a huge challenge because we couldn't, you know, use that account for 6 months.
Dang, man.
What did it cost you in the end to do that?
At the end, it ended up costing $3,000.
Oh, shit. And then did you have that blue check mark when that happened?
No, that came out like literally 2 weeks after my account was hacked. Mm-hmm. I was so pissed. I was like, man, I would have done it because I can't tell you how many times before that they did the verification where you could just pay for it, that people would reach out to me like, hey, bro, you know, you have this fake account. I'm like, I know I have this fake account. And I would post about it, but it was like no value to my followers to tell them, you know, like, or to my page to just continually post like, hey, I got fake accounts. I got fake accounts. Like, yeah, obviously. And because they would just use every little, they'd put a period or they'd spell, yeah, you know, with an O, they put a zero. I mean, these guys are super creative and it really did look like my account. So it was a frustration for quite some time, but now I'm, you know, I have these two accounts and the other account, the second one, I'm going to turn into a Spanish speaking only account. That was one of the takeaways I got from this recent conference I just went to this past week.
Oh yeah, that's a great idea.
I tell you what, out of all the accounts that have hit me up, I've had the fake Jay Scott account hit me up the most. I hit that guy up like six times. I'm like, dude, another Jay Scott hit me up. He's like, dude.
Well, Instagram goals, get famous enough like Alex Camacho and people start coming after you, I guess, right? Well, I'm glad you're back with that. Now, you're in Phoenix right now, is that right? Or you're in Arizona?
Yeah, I'm in Phoenix, Arizona. Flew in last night from Vegas. I was at WealthCon, the conference, and now I'm here because I have a multifamily value add deal that I'm working on here, an 18 unit.
Yeah, and you said, now, did you just buy that, or was that is that under contract, or where where are you at in the process with it?
I purchased it in the middle of 2022, right before the whole market changed. So this one has been my biggest pain in the ass in my entire life. Yeah.
What? tell us about it. What's the deal? Maybe if you could break it down for us, I'm interested.
Yeah, for sure. So my primary focus is fixing and flipping single family houses in Southern California, predominantly in Los Angeles County. And so as I began to have a good amount of success in that strategy, obviously it comes with a lot of taxable income because, you know, we flip a house, we make some money, and that's all taxable. Well, I decided to purchase a multifamily because it was going to help me through cost segregation. And also, I had a small portfolio of single families in Southern California and a couple in Hawaii, but I didn't really want to have a huge portfolio of single family houses in LA, particularly because of the tenant laws and all that. So I did some research. You know, I went and flew to a couple of the markets I was interested in. That was Phoenix, San Antonio, and parts of South Florida. And once I did that, I determined that Arizona was like really the best fit for me. I also travel full time for listeners. So unlike some investors and people that get some level of success, they like to buy things and have a lot of fancy stuff. For me, I'm more about lifestyle than anything. Lifestyle by design is sort of the way I live. So I actually live in multiple places. I live in Guadalajara, Mexico, which is my motherland, we'll say, because it's where my mom is from. And I would go there throughout my childhood. So I have a huge penthouse apartment there that I get to live in like pretty much as a king for like very affordable prices. So I love it. And I also have some virtual assistants down there. So I love it. But I also live in Hawaii. I got a chance to move out to Maui a couple years ago during the pandemic and mentor under Brandon Turner, one of my main mentors. And so I get to live in basically these three cool places of Hollywood, LA, and Mexico and Hawaii. So I want to be able to travel to the real estate that I own. And I noticed that Phoenix kind of stood out. And so I decided to plant my flag and say, hey, I want to have a multifamily building in Phoenix because I believe in the market. I got to meet a lot of people. I just believed in it. And there's direct flights from Mexico, Guadalajara. There's direct flights from Maui. There's direct flights from LA. So, you know, just logistically, it made sense for me. And also Phoenix, if you guys have ever been, it's a vibrant, cool, fun city. So it just really matched my investment targets. And so I decided to just tell everybody I want to buy something. Something came in my network. I wanted to get something maybe about 8 to 10 unit building. This 18 unit building came across my desk and I decided to purchase it. I didn't syndicate it. I actually took it down with my own equity and then raised some debt capital and purchased it. But that was like in May 2022. And the market completely turned the next month. Interest rates started to go up. We experienced all the interest rates. We went over budget on the construction, on the rehab, on the value add. I didn't pivot fast enough on maybe spending less per unit. Also, you know, working with a bridge lender, which is essentially just a hard money lender for commercial real estate, multifamily real estate. And they were very difficult to work with. I won't say no names, but they've continued to be very difficult to work with because it's not like single family. So they withheld a huge part of the construction budget because we weren't going to rehab a couple of the units. Although we're still adding value, we're still raising rents, and we were hitting our targets. They just were real assholes about it, and so I had to put up more money. Even before that, when I acquired the property, the mortgage broker that quoted me, the deal and all the numbers and everything like that, the cash to close changed from high 600,000 to 825 to 1,000,001 in like a week. And I had $175,000 of hard deposit. So I was either going to lose this $175,000 or I was just going to, bridge the difference. So I had to use more of my capital to do that, to acquire it. And then I had to use more of my capital to help finish the building or, parts of the building of the value add. And then, we weren't really getting the rents that we expected. So we had to start adding some midterm and short-term rentals into the mix. And then meanwhile, I flipped real estate in Southern California. I need cash to do that. And so this whole time, 2023, guess what? There's less people wanting to be private lenders because they're scared of the market. And then we finish off a flip. And then that private lender also doesn't want to renew and do some more, investing with us, because even though we did everything according to plan and they earned a great interest rate. So it was just this convergence in 2003 and then like we just talked about my Instagram being down. So it's harder for me to, get more money, partners and capital. So, I mean, it's a miracle that really I was just able to kind of navigate through the whole shitstorm. And we're about to finish the value add deal and hopefully we'll be able to sell it or refinance it. But it's been a dogfight, man. Seriously.
Yeah. Now, do you I think when we have more time that elapses between, 2022 and kind of the recent stuff we've gone through, I think we're probably going to look back eventually and be like, oh my God, you bought that during that time. You know what I mean? Because like I've had some really major difficulties with, financing and lending also for a big multifamily project I have going during that same time frame. We bought it and then everything changed. All the costs went up, supply material availability went down. So the lead time was a lot more extended. You had to make choices on what to rehab, what to not rehab. Do you execute on the original business plan? Do you create a new one? What's that going to mean for, getting rehab money from a lender like you talked about? Yeah, it's just kudos.
And to add to that, at year one, because this was a one-year bridge loan, guess what? They're like, well, the market's changed, so we need to reevaluate where you're at, and we need you to pay down the principal by $500,000. And I was like, holy moly. And we didn't even have $500,000 in the coffers ready to just like sort of pay them down. And remember, granted, this is not to help finish the project. This is just to satisfy the risk of the lender and provide a 6-month extension. So we went back and forth negotiating, and then they settled at $300,000 and putting a lien on my big house in Maui to offset their risk, and didn't really even help us out whatsoever. And so we've been in this constant struggle of the cash crunch because of this lender. And I'm up against this same thing right now. Like they want another $200,000 again, not even to finish the project in any sort. So it's been a big challenge because of that. But that movie Shawshank Redemption?
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like Andy Dufresne right now. And we're, I'm still going through it right now with the whole situation, but I better believe it. Once this is done, I'm going to also be on a beach in Mexico, really up a lot of money.
Yeah, that's funny because he's like, you're still in the sewage, right? Like when he finally gets out, cool. All the rain's coming down. Yeah, that's coming, man. You're almost on the tail end of it.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, so I'm curious, one more question on that. What is a 18-unit value-add deal in Phoenix cost? Or what did it cost then, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah, we bought it for about $200,000 per door.
Okay.
It was projected to be worth, say, $260,000, $270,000 per door. But the transaction volume has gone down so much. Not necessarily the valuations, because it's a stalemate. The transaction volume has gone down 70% inside, year after year, because multifamily owners are like, I'm not selling my property for that. And buyers are like, I'm not buying a property with that kind of financing available to me. So it's just been a huge stalemate. And same thing with me. I'm like, I have the option now of selling the property for more than $1 million loss, letting it go back to the bank. Although we're on time with payments and everything, or just sticking through it. And then on the back end, maybe selling it at break-even point and having a huge liquidity event, and obviously learning a lot from the process, or you know, maybe refinancing. But because I have those debt investors, it's likely going to be more of a sale later this year or early 2025 when things are just better overall.
Man. Well, hey, speaking of $1 million, I had a note here to ask you. Did you have $1 million profit on a flip? Is that true?
It wasn't a flip. It was that Maui house that we purchased and kept, and it was like a big boy burr.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Would you mind? How did you get involved in the Maui scene? And like, I'm just curious how you navigate that. I know you mentioned you're kind of a nomad with where you live and what you know your business activities, but like why Maui? How does that even work when you're, you know, traveling out so much?
Yeah. So just a little bit of backstory on that. I began working in real estate investing at the beginning of 2017, but I began by working for a savage investor in Southern California as an acquisitions person. And I worked for him for about a year. That's where I cut my teeth. Didn't make very much money. And then I went to go work for a bigger company that recruited me through the process of just posting on Facebook. Somebody saw that I was, you know, getting deals. And so they offered me a position. I worked for them for about a year and a half. So I call that part of my journey the apprenticeship phase, because I really wasn't targeting making a lot of money during that time. It was more of like, let me learn the business. Obviously, towards the second year, into the third year, I was, you know, starting to make money at that point. But I helped those two investment companies acquire about 65 houses in Southern California during that time and learned a ton and saved a couple hundred thousand dollars. So middle of 2019, I kind of just was like, dropped the mic. I got enough money to like flip houses on my own. I've learned it enough. I have the contacts. So I took a vacation to Maui with my ex-girlfriend. And I was a huge fan of Bigger Pockets and Brandon Turner and that whole ecosystem for investors. So sent him a DM. He actually invited me to attend his church and just to, you know, we were going to go and, you know, we were going to go say hello to him. And so we did. And he was so gracious, man. Like the real deal, sat down with me for a good part, about 45 minutes. And while his wife and his daughter, Rosie, at the time, just, he didn't have Wilder, his second child yet. And he was telling me about his mobile home park acquisition dream and what he was going to be doing with that. And he really liked my story of just the grit, hustle, working for other people, taking that route. So he invited me to this mastermind that he was going to be having called the Maui Mastermind. It's kind of infamous now because there was a lot of people that connected during that time, including him connecting with somebody that he scaled up. He scaled up the Open Door Capital with Brian Murray. And so what ended up happening was he invited me to come to his mastermind. I jumped on the opportunity because it was going to be like in 10 days. And I was the smallest fish in that room, I feel like, by far. I got to meet AJ Osborne, Ryan Pineda, some of these big names in real estate investing. They weren't as big as they are now, but you know, it really expanded my mind, my vision. I was already kind of headed in a positive direction. So that mastermind was all about setting the vision that you want to accomplish. And so I went back to LA and just executed. And about a year passed by, and then the pandemic hit. And then he reached out to me because he wanted to flip more houses in Maui because he was going to scale up his operation. So he wanted some more active income, and he knew I was great at acquisitions. So we worked out this deal where I was going to kind of move to Hawaii. And I was like, yeah, I'm all for it. It's middle pandemic. You want me to flip some houses with you, Brandon Turner? Let's effing go. And so we were at the 5-yard line with the deal, but it involved a three-party. It was me, his ex-partner, I won't say his name, and him, and we were going to be three-way partners. The ex-partner was going to be more of like just operations, project management. I was going to be acquisitions, and then Brandon was going to be the money. Well, he pulled back. He didn't really want to do it because he didn't really want to work with that person anymore, but he still left the door open and said, hey, why don't you just come to Maui, hang out, get you on the podcast, and, you know, we could work on your personal branding. You know, you could just be here for the wintertime, which Hawaii is amazing to be here during the wintertime. And then we can just kind of go from there. So long story short, I jumped on the opportunity because I no longer had the obligation to go and do deals, but I still had the opportunity to be kind of mentored by Brandon and be in that whole, you know, Maui ecosystem, because Brandon doesn't really do business with people. Like, he does life with people. And so he wanted to, you know, be with people that are going to, you know, be go-getters, but also that he thought were cool and that want to kind of hang around with at times. And so I was there for, I think, a couple of weeks once I moved over there. And then he got me on the podcast. That helped with my, you know, my reach and my Instagram growth. And then I just really loved Hawaii. So I stayed there and then helped build this remote company where, like, essentially I already knew Southern California, right? I knew the market. I already had 3-4 flips going at one time. So I just designed a company where I didn't really have to be there physically. And so he told me, don't start working on deals here in Hawaii until you already have everything kind of dialed in over there in Los Angeles. So I did that. It took about 3 months where I had my team just starting to get a couple deals a month. And then that's started searching for deals over there in Hawaii. We started doing these driving for dollar campaigns where we drive around the neighborhoods, get some addresses. And we logged in about 700 addresses throughout Maui. And I just started sending direct mail to those. We got this monster deal. And that deal was interesting because so many things can change on a deal over time. And I think that's a lesson I learned on this one, where I first locked up the deal. I think it was like $1.35 million. It was a 3,500 square foot house with an ocean view, only a couple streets over from Brandon's house. And the guy was a motivated seller from the mainland. He had a couple houses in Hawaii. And so I was able to actually negotiate, after I locked the deal up in escrow, seller financing on that one. And so because I was able to negotiate seller financing rather than get hard money, then it helped us have a little bit more of a runway on that deal. And we had a lower, you know, cost. But during the time that I wasn't doing deals and I was working on the LA operation, I wasn't sitting idle. I was actually networking with all these Hawaii investors just to kind of get a lay of the land. And that's so important to just get like understanding of a new market that you're planning to do business in, because oftentimes you'll just go in with the strategies you already had success with and just try to apply the same thing, when that's not what you should do. You should really kind of understand what's happening. And that's what I did. So I made some connections. So once I got that deal, I pitched it to like Brandon, to also to, you know, all the people that I had met. And somebody recommended this guy that wanted to buy a property on the mainland. He was from the mainland, but he wanted to buy, you know, in Maui, in this particular neighborhood, because it's very in demand, an exclusive neighborhood. So he flew out like on a moment's notice. And during COVID, it was hard to get into Hawaii. Like, you had to have a COVID test within 3 days. And then sometimes the laboratories would take some time to get you that test back. And then people would fly into Hawaii and get sent back. It was nuts, man. And so he hit that hurdle, came for the inspection, and he's like, I like the deal. Let's go. So I found this JV partner, and this guy put up $600,000 because I was part of the seller financing. The guy wanted to pay off a $400,000 hard money loan that was coming due and $200 in his pocket, and he was willing to finance the other remainder, which was $750,000. So we negotiated that deal. I was the operator, 50-50. He was the money partner on the mainland. Dude, I fired two contractors. Even before the contractors, I had to negotiate with three tenants. There was three tenants on the property because there was a single, an ohana, which is really an ADU, an accessory dwelling unit on the bottom, a 2-bedroom, 1-bath, and a main floor unit of 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms. So it was a pretty big property. And Hawaii is also tenant friendly. But because I had so much experience with negotiating with uncooperative tenants in a tenant friendly state as California, that gave me a lot of confidence. And then I was able to successfully negotiate with these three savvy tenants and get them out. And then I'm rehabbing the property with two different contractors that I end up firing both of those, because in Hawaii, man, it's hard to find great labor. So it was just a series of issue after issue after issue. But during this time, this is COVID, so it starts to shoot up his value. And my JV partner hits me up. He's like, hey, bro, do you see the comps on this thing now? And I was like, what's wrong? He's like, bro, they're in the low twos, because their ARV was like 175 to 19, like on a quick flip. We're going to buy 135, just, you know, spruce it up, maybe put 50 to 75 into it, because it was built in like 1993. So it was not like an old house. It was just, you know, kind of like lived in for some time from the tenants. And so he's like, bro, this is like a potential property we can keep. And I was like, oh yeah, let's do it. Keep a big old house in Maui. Let's go, baby. And so we went for a refinanced on it through like one of those DSCR loans, and it just went awful. We picked some lender that did loans in Hawaii, but there's a difference between being licensed in Hawaii and doing loans and actually like really knowing, again, the lay of the land and how things work, and really doing a lot of loans in Hawaii, particularly because the price points are so high. And then we just kind of like demoralized. We're like, damn, we're not going to be able to pull this off. All right, let's just put it on the market for like 2 point, like high number, see if we can get $1 million payday. At the time, I think we were into the deal like high 1.67 or 1.7. So we put it on the market for like 2.6 or 2.7. I don't even remember now. And then we got an offer for like 2.45. But after we ran the numbers, I was like, nah, bro, that's not enough, man. We got to get a big payday, or we shouldn't let this property go because it has so much upside. It's by Brandon Turner's house. It's, you know, a massive property. It's ocean view. It's on a 30,000 square foot lot that, you know, we could build more, you know, an ADU, more property on. It was just so much upside to that deal. And you can't say that about every deal. So ended up, I just convinced him. I was like, you know what? Let's just give it another shot on the refi. You know, we just have to structure it differently, you know, just let's figure it out. And so we did, and we were able to pull it off, and we literally got $1 million wire on the cash out refinance and kept the property. And I didn't even get a dollar of that cash out refinance because, you know, we kept, you know, he got his money back. And then we just kept the property, and we just 50-50. And now we have a magical Maui estate that it's kind of my, it's basically my trophy property and the best deal I've ever done, to be honest.
Dang, man, that's sweet. So do you then end up using it as like a short-term rental out there, or how does that work? Or is that just the Camacho crash pad?
I love it. Well, I got to live in it for a good amount of time. We did strategically do some events there and some hosting there, but it is not permitted to do Airbnb and short-term rentals on single family houses there in Maui. So we had a difficult time. We were kind of like negative in cash flow, like $5,000-$6,000 a month. And it was tough because, you know, the payment's $13,000. But what happened was that there was a big fire on Maui, you know, this past year. So thousands of people, you know, about 1,000 houses burned down during that Lahaina fire. And so we were able to rent it for $20,000 a month to one of these big families that lost their house, you know, in the fire. So now it's cash flowing. It's, you know, we did something good with renting it to a family of 14 that lost their big house in Lahaina. 14. And so now it's kind of, yeah, so it was kind of like, it's bittersweet in the sense that I like to use the property and be able to, you know, be there in Maui. But like, we also didn't want to like being, we didn't like being negative, you know, $5,000-$6,000 a month that we were splitting in between. And we have this huge amount of equity, but if it's not cash flowing, like it's not ideal. So now it's cash flowing and it's in good hands with a family that's taking care of it. And we'll push the puck down the road and see if we can refinance it again, get some cash out or sell it. But my partner and I definitely want to keep it long term. We think that property could be worth, you know, $4 million, $5 million down the road.
That is amazing. $20,000 a month. That is incredible. Yeah.
With that property, yeah. When you got those tenants out, did you do cash or keys, or how do you get them out?
Yeah, fantastic question. So I budgeted $35,000 and I got them out for $34,000 because I knew that I was going to have a trouble with more than one on the top, because that person on the top was very savvy and, you know, would just use the whole eviction moratorium that Maui had during that time as leverage. But also, like, I'm not intimidated by tenants by all the experience I have with them. And so, like, we were just getting into it. But I knew I just had to get one person out. And once I got one person out, then I would be able to do what's called a kind of a construction eviction. so meaning like I got the person downstairs out, and then it became a construction zone. You know, then it became a construction zone where I'm like, you know, having an active crew in there, you know, that there's like just, you know, noisy and all that. And so, you know, now it no longer was like their home. And so they actually were like, you know, they just didn't feel the same. So then I got the one out, and then that domino fell, and then I got the other one out, and then I got the other one out. So it was kind of a series over like 2 months of negotiating with them to get all three of them out for under budget, $34,000 at budget $35,000. And I forgot who I was showing the deal to, but people were like, why are you going to pay them so much money? I'm like, dude, you have no idea. Like, these people have some leverage on us. Like, they could just, you know, they can just stick, you know, what do they call that when they just dig their heels? They can just dig their heels and make my life hell, because if I can't get possession of the property, I can't rehab it, and I can't add value. So I have to give them some money and some free rent, because I've done that so many times in Southern California, and it worked.
Wow. I can't imagine. Well, Alex, now, if you wouldn't mind, talk about your flipping operation in Southern California. Like, that is, I would imagine, probably in the U.S., if not the most, it's got to be up there with the most competitive flipping or real estate investing market probably in the country. Is that fair to say, do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But I grew up in SoCal, so my operation consists of buying. I buy across LA County, but essentially I'm predominantly working in the entry level working class neighborhood. So the average house in Los Angeles goes for about $700,000 now, $600,000 to $700,000, depending on what neighborhood you're in. And I typically am purchasing in certain parts of South LA for $400,000 to $500,000, certain parts of the edge of the city, which is kind of the desert part. It's called Antelope Valley. We've crushed it in that area. It's Palmdale, Lancaster. It's not the cool part of LA, but I'm buying houses there in LA County for $200,000 to $300,000 all day, every day, because the average houses in that area is about $400,000, because they're newer built. They have a little bit more land, but they're now outside of the city, but they're still in the LA County. So I've crushed it out there. I got some rentals. They're cash flowing there in California. So I really found my niche through working for those two other companies. The first guy, I learned a lot of how to really analyze deals, how to negotiate with sellers, how to do some of those things and just get deep discounted deals. And then the other company I worked for, because they were much more of a volume shop, I just learned how, you know, if you do volume, you're eventually, you know, volume being like more than a couple, you know, like half dozen, like if you're doing 20, 30 flips a year, like it just, as long as you're working at certain price points, you should average out and, you know, just like make your minimum profit on flips, but then also have the opportunity to come across deals that are going to be home runs. Because if you're not doing volume, it's kind of hard to hit home runs, if that makes sense. Yeah. But you do have to have, you know, a certain minimum profit, a kind of a certain a purchase criteria. And then that's our purchase criteria. We're in entry level. So if someone said, hey, you want to buy a house for $500,000 in the Palmdale Lancaster area, that's an automatic decline for me, because that's $100,000 over the average price point for that area. And you know, someone told me, oh, you want to buy a house for $700,000 in, you know, South LA, same thing. That's an automatic decline, because, you know, once people have the ability to buy that, they're qualified to buy at that price, then they can go into adjacent other better areas in that area. So I don't want to be the most expensive house in that neighborhood, or in, you know, that I'm selling. So that's kind of our purchase criteria. And then we do about 25 deals a year. I keep the best ones, and then I use what I make to buy in other areas that are cash flowing, that are more rental markets, such as Arizona. And then the Hawaii houses. I have three houses in Hawaii, but I'm selling one, and the other two are just long-term holds for appreciation.
Now, do you mainly focus on off-market strategies when it comes to acquisitions, or do you do kind of a mix of MLS deals and off-market? What's that look like?
Currently, we are mainly focusing on we do off market. We haven't done as much in the last couple of years because I think there's some context too. As I host the largest free real estate investor meetup in Southern California, you know, we get a couple hundred people come out every month and a half or so. And so we get some deal flow from just like the amount of networking that we have and the reach that we have. But I buy about one house a month on MLS. We have a good system for that. So we're purchasing consistently from there. I buy houses from my following on social media. I buy houses from wholesalers and just the networking and the agent relationships that we have built over time. So that's our kind of primary sources of deals. But we also strategically do the off market through marketing to areas that we already have properties. So if I buy a property in this area, we're going to hit that area hard with some cold calling, with some text messaging, just because we want to do what's called anchoring, where if we already know we got this great deal, we're going to try to buy some more deals around that same area. So, but you know, LA County's big. So, you know, it's hard. We can't market to the entire area. And I'm not really a traditional wholesaler where I'm just wholesaling a lot. I'll do some, but I'm more of like, I want to buy real estate. I want to hold real estate, and I want to flip the stuff that I don't want to hold.
I have a question for you that I was thinking about here. You've got three different real estate markets that you've gotten kind of ingrained into, not including your Guadalajara presence there, but you've got, you know, you mentioned Arizona, you've got Southern California, you've got Hawaii. Let's, if somebody's catching this episode and they're like, you know what, I'm kind of priced out of my area, I'd like to go set up shop somewhere and get an active, like, let's say it's a flipping business like you have, an acquisitions type of a setup. What are, if you are going to pick a new market in the U.S. somewhere, how would you approach getting started there? What steps might you take? What people should be involved? If you wouldn't mind kind of like exploring that I think somebody catching this might get some good, you know, good tips from you on that.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. So I think nothing replaces physically seeing the real estate itself. I think there's a lot of value from that, but also evaluating. So somebody asked me that at the conference yesterday, I think. I told them, well, hey, if I sent you a house in, you know, what zip code you live in? Okay, if I send you a house there that's 1,500 square feet, do you know what that house would sell for if it was completely rehab? And he didn't know. I'm like, well, how do you know if it's a good deal if you don't know your value? So I think that's one huge step. And the way I used to do it is I literally would go through hundreds, if not thousands, of real estate listings to see what does the house sell for completely rehab in this neighborhood, and what does the house sell for in this area and in this condition. And so there's so much value that, you know, so much learning from looking at real estate listings and seeing what something is selling for, because you start to see patterns. Okay, this area is this price, this area is this price. And so, and once you're searching for opportunities through whatever method that may be, that might be cold calling, that might be talking to wholesalers and getting deals there, that might be, you know, MLS, but now you know your values in that area. So I think that's one big piece of it. And I would also drive in neighborhoods. Now, again, if you're going to be remote, that might be a little bit difficult because you do have to go visit there. But I wanted to master knowing the values of Los Angeles County. So if I saw that we were doing a lot of deals as a company, back when I was working for the second company in this area, I would just go drive that zip code, go to the local places, see, go to, you know, the local parks. I would just literally drive around, because as an investor, like, knowledge of your market is one of the most important pieces of the whole thing. So I think it's just getting a knowledge of the market that you're interested in on a very granular level and a high level. So just knowing that area would be number one. And number two, I think I would want to network with investors and see what's happening, see what they're doing, see what's working for them in that particular area. And that you can do that virtually. You don't need to do that. You know, so making connections with other people to get a peek into their business. And you're not going to do that just like, hey, what's your business model? Like, what are you doing? And you got to make real connections. And I think people, when they're getting started, they tend to think that they can't provide any value. But sometimes it's an introduction. Sometimes it's something that you've done and had success with that maybe you could share with them. Sometimes it could be a book recommendation. There's all types of ways that you could provide value to people. Sometimes it's just having just good energy, like, right? I, like, a lot of people say they like my energy because, like, I'm enthusiastic. I like what I'm doing. I'm passionate about what I'm doing. So that transfers over to my communication with people. So that could be a value. So I think just making some genuine connections would be probably a follow-up step to, like, actually knowing the market. Because then you can start asking questions based on knowing the market. And then you're talking to these people that are doing business. And then just start building your team out. Like, you need to get somebody. If you're not strong in sales, then you need to get someone strong in sales in your team. That could be a virtual assistant. That could be someone that you're hiring directly to work for you. So I think the lifeblood of this business is getting deals, you know, opportunities, finding deals. So I think that that's very important. Fortunately for me, like, I'm strong in sales, negotiation, and all these areas to acquire deals. So I started on that part. I started working for other investors so I could really learn from them how I could evaluate deals, how I could, you know, get deals consistently. Because it's not about just getting one deal. It's about doing deals consistently. For me, that was always the goal. Like, how do I find one great deal in Southern California a month? And that turned into, you know, how can I get one, you know, for the second company? I was trending. I was working so hard that I was getting them like a deal a week at one point. My best month, I got them 8 deals. Like, to be able to help another investor close on 8 deals in 1 month, that takes a massive amount of work. So I think that's another part of it too. It's like, you just have to be willing to put in a massive amount of work, because these deals are not really found. They're created. They're created through the actions, through the connections, through all the deliberate, you know, deliberate action that you're doing to source real estate investment deals, because they're just not going to just fall in your lap. You have to create the opportunities and jump on them. So those are a couple of steps I would take. And then through the, you know, networking and everything, you're going to figure out what they have going on. And then you could somehow duplicate that, or I like to say remix it. I've learned a lot from my mentors, and then I don't like copy what they're doing. I just remix it to what, you know, my style, to what I'm doing or what I want to do. So I don't know. Hopefully that's helpful.
That's great. So my takeaway from that is, market knowledge is, you have to start there, get to know, so you understand what a deal even is, right? So market knowledge, people, discipline, grind. I think it sounds like those are kind of the four main ingredients. So there's no substitute for working hard and understanding what the market is. I think a lot of newer investors especially kind of just want to fast forward and skip over the step where they actually go through understanding what makes up a deal and the processes behind it. So
the fourth one I'll add to that, I think is reflection. And the reason I say reflection is because if you do the review of the market, you know the market. And then if you go out there and meet some people, see what's working for them. And then based on all that, you go take a lot of action, make 100 offers, whatever that is, just a massive amount of action. You need to review your results on a regular basis to see what is working. And maybe you didn't get your first deal yet, but at least you made some progress in that month, 2 months of grinding and say, okay, you know what? This seems to be clicking. This isn't working. Or, hey, I need more help on this. And then continue to do those other steps, because when you take action, your questions are different. So if I said, hey, you know, Owen, I went and made 100 offers over in Omaha. I learned this. Can you help me with this? Like, you're more likely to help me because I just went and took action. And I'm asking you a question based on that action, not some theory. Because too many of the new guys just get caught up in theory, not enough action. And then they're not asking questions based on the results that they've gotten in the action they've taken.
That is so good. Yeah, that is a great tip right there. I love it. Yeah, you're exactly right. Your questions are going to change when you're actually involved in it, because reading something in a book, hearing it on a podcast, or just studying online is a way different thing than actually going out, walking through a property, dealing with motivated sellers, and making offers. So yeah, I love that. Such gold, man. Good stuff there.
Alex, you're grinding all the time. You're working, but what do you do to disconnect from all that? What's the thing that you do to kind of get away?
Yeah, great question. I have a couple of hobbies, a couple of things I like to do for leisure. When I'm in Hawaii, I've taken up free diving. So if you guys ever seen that, going underwater without a scuba tank. I've always been a big swimmer. Part of the reason I love Hawaii so much, because you can swim in the ocean anytime you want. Yeah, people are scared of sharks and all that, but I learned also about shark behavior, and I've actually swam with them. So I'm not saying I'm not scared of them, but it's part of the ecosystem. When you're in the ocean swimming, 20, 30 feet deep, you'll see things. So I love getting out there inside of the water, or just swimming in general. When I'm in Guadalajara, I have an amazing pool on the 22nd floor of my luxury kind of high rise building. And so I love swimming and staying in shape through that. I do a lot of that. And then in Southern California, I took about a decade ago, I took up a trail running. And so I really, really love getting up in the mountains, just going hard. Something about just running up mountains is very kind of similar to our grind and what we do, right? We're climbing mountains, we're grinding hard in business. And then we get to that top of that mountain. We're we close that big deal. We get that big check. Or we do that big burn, get that cash flow going on that deal, and that deal is done. And it's just that reward that we get. And I find that to be very similar. So I go hiking a lot in LA. And then I've been kind of single for the last couple of years. So, I'm quite active in my single life, particularly when I'm in Guadalajara, Mexico. So I'll leave it at that. But I love, being out there and enjoying the company of some gorgeous women all over the world. So
I love it. Hey, I was going to ask you, I've noticed you beating the crap out of one of those heavy mannequins before. Are you into self-defense, or is that more of a cardio workout where you've got gloves on and you're just pounding away at them?
Yeah, I know. People find that one funny because I put different captions, squatter relocation training, And I'm hitting the little guy, boom. Or this is how I feel. This is what I want to do, my multifamily lender right now. People just crack up. So, no, I think I was a boxer or something in a previous life. But, and there used to be this famous boxer with the same last name. They used to call him Macho Camacho.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I just love boxing, man. So, no, it's more of a both. I like doing it. And then, I'm a little bit of a, I grew up in the ghetto, and I grew up in very rough situations, and so I've been in some street fights. So I don't like to I'm not I like to say I'm a lover, not a fighter, but I just like boxing in general.
Have you on the topic of kind of how you were brought up, you've got a really big personality, and I think I would call it almost a magnetic presence. So I can see why you've done well with meetups and starting your own. And you've obviously been on podcasts. We know each other because of being at, the Bigger Pockets conference and all that. You mentioned a rough upbringing. What do you attribute your success in going kind of down the right path, as opposed to maybe, getting caught up with the wrong crowd and ending up in prison or worse? That can happen to a lot of people that grow up in, in rough times.
Yeah. That's very relevant. I think I could have went down that path. I saw a lot of my friends go down that path. So I grew up in Southern California in the 80s, 90s, and it was really, really dominated by gang culture and all that. Obviously not as much now, but it certainly was throughout my childhood. And I think what really saved me was I just had two good parents that were hard workers, immigrants. And, you know, I actually did get arrested several, like a half dozen times before I turned 18 for just, you know, shoplifting and graffiti. I was a graffiti artist and all that stuff. So I like to say I just had all this energy, enthusiasm for life, but I just didn't have anywhere to channel it because we were so broke. We didn't have, you know, we couldn't put me in organized sports. We couldn't afford any of that. So I just didn't have like the vehicle for me to channel all this energy that I had. And once I found sales and stepped into like having a banking job and being able to make more money for myself. Actually, my first job ever I got was telemarketing. And so I think once I started making money for myself and saw, hey man, like if I work hard, I could really make a lot of money and then just live the life that I want. Because when my parents left me alone a lot when I was younger, I took it more of like, I just became very independent. So I think that independence came from knowing that like, hey, my parents are out there working and providing for me. I got to go to, you know, kind of fend for myself, so to speak. I didn't look at that as a negative thing. I looked at it as a positive thing. Like they let me kind of figure out, you know, my destiny, what I want to do with my life. And, you know, fortunately I came across sales and all that. And so, but once I came across, you know, banking and when I, right out of high school, I kind of opened my eyes up to the financial world and how, you know, people, are so different. Like I remember seeing people that would come in and they'd be dressed like in a snazzy suit. They were dressed to the nines and they looked like they were loaded with money. And then I'd look at their bank account because I'm a bank teller and they were broke. They were negative and they were complaining about these overdraft fees. And then I'd see a nice old lady walk up that just looked an average woman. And then she had $100,000 in her bank account. I'm like, dude, like I can't. So that taught me not to judge a book by its cover that very early on in life. But that banking also helped me to see that, hey, man, like there's a whole world of finances that I'm not familiar with and I need to get more familiar with it. So it was a great foundation. I love banking. I would have stayed in banking for long term, but I didn't because it has a really limited upside for like income. And I always wanted to have like my destiny, like in my own control of like how much money I can make. And I found out to be like not available in banking because like you're only going to make so much. You're going to maybe be a branch manager and make 100 grand a year, but I wanted to make a hell of a lot more than that. So yeah that was kind of my base. Yeah.
So what was your first influence into real estate investing? What made you think that this could work?
So back in the mortgage crisis, so I had been in the mortgage business right out of right from banking. I went into the mortgage business, and that's when I made my first six figures. And I was like 23 years old. I'm 42 now. So and I went hard, and I made $100,000 my first time I made that was 2000. I think it was like 2004. I know that dates me a lot. So once I started doing that, and then the whole thing fell apart in 2008, and I had like three houses, a couple of businesses, but it was all highly leveraged as far as like 100% financing loans, those exotic loans. And then I ended up losing all of that in 2010, 2011 through all that crisis. But I started to see a lot of real estate investors. Because I ended up getting my real estate license at that time because I saw that might be a better, you know, angle for me to go because the mortgage business just fell apart. And I started to see a lot of investors in Southern California that I was doing short sales for. At the time, the short sales, that's where like so much of the deals were that. And so I'd work for like 8 months, 10 months to get this short sale approval from the bank. And then the investor would just come in and buy it, flip it, make $100,000 profit. In Southern California, you know, there were some huge rips. And I'm like, damn, man, these guys are making some big bucks. I am making $10,000 on this deal, but they're making $100,000 on that deal just to keep the numbers simple, right? I'm like, they're making 10x money, but they're not doing 10x amount of work. So we're doing almost equal amount of work, but they're making 10 times more money. So I'm not a math wizard, but I was like, dude, I got to do what they're doing. So that's where the seed was planted. But then I got lured back into the mortgage business on the wholesale side, did some Airbnb arbitrage. But it was always in the back of my mind, like, damn, I think I could be a great house flipper. I think I want to be a full-time investor. But it wasn't until I came across Bigger Pockets, like 2016, later on is when I really found like, okay, my angle here is to go work for an investor. I just didn't have that idea in my mind. I just said, I don't have money, so I can't be an investor. These people have money, they're investors. But you know, it's really interesting because I went to go work for these two companies, right, for that 2.5 years, saved a couple hundred thousand dollars, but making a lot of money for them. And then I got my first deal on my own. And then the hard money lender didn't want to give me the money to do the deal because they said I hadn't been on title on any of these houses. And so I had to go find a JV partner. And then he put up all the money, put the hard money loan in his name. And I didn't even use any of the money I saved. But without the skills I learned during that time, I wouldn't be able to acquire that deal. So it's such a catch-22, right? That like I did all this work and I thought I needed money. But the reality is, if you find a great deal, you don't need the money.
Very true.
Alex, I love the story about how you came up because I think that we all have that story. And I think that kind of creates who we are is our past, right? But there is a section of our podcast, which is my personal favorite section. We almost named the podcast after this, but it's called Failing Forward.
And this Failing Forward is brought to you by JM Real Estate Capital.
Hi, it's Rob, JM Real Estate Capital. We're the money guys that you need to know for all your real estate investments. Talk to us. We can do what your local bank can't or won't do. 844-WE-CLOSE or go online, jmrecapital.com. That's jmrecapital.com. JM Real Estate Capital, smart solutions for the real estate investor.
And Failing Forward is a section where you had a mistake in your business or personal life, if you don't have a business one, and there was a big learning lesson that came out of it. Do you have an example of that?
Yeah. So I think the big one was those joint ventures that I did early on. So joint ventures have been an integral part of my success, particularly early on. I think they're very valuable for potential new investors. And one of the things I failed was not having the proper paperwork or not having my interest in the deal secured, so to speak. And so this joint venture partner that I secured on my first flip that I just mentioned that I had the money, had the deal, but the hard money lender didn't want to give me the loan because I hadn't been on title on any of these other deals that I secured for these other investors that I had been working for. So the first deal worked out great because, you know, we made some money. I wasn't on title. I trusted this guy. This is somebody that I knew for a decade. I met him back in banking. He was an older gentleman that invested in real estate. He had been following me on Facebook. He knew what I was working on because I had been posting regularly about it. So we decided to do this joint venture deal. It worked out great. Then I got another deal, but this other deal was different. This was a duplex. And because he was more of a buy and hold investor, I recognized like, hey, he's probably going to want to keep this property long term, but I need money to keep on operating to do my flipping business. So we worked out this 50-50 joint partnership on it, but I didn't have any paperwork. Like I wasn't on title. We didn't fill out any joint venture agreement, you know, notarized like I do now. I didn't have any real recourse. And he ended up muscling me out of the deal because we had some issues with getting the second tenant out. And so he downplayed the value of the property. I don't remember the exact numbers, but I mean, I was due about $75,000 on that deal because it was a monster deal. And then he only gave me $40,000. So I ended up losing like $35,000 on that deal because I didn't have my paperwork in order. I didn't have my security, interest. I didn't have what I needed to have recourse in case that things didn't go according to plan. And then kind of concurrently with that, I was doing another deal, another joint venture deal with another entrepreneur, a guy that I respected a lot. He didn't invest in that first joint venture deal and he saw that we killed it on that deal. So he was really ready to jump on another deal with me. Well, I got this deal and that deal ended up turning a little bit sticky too because it was a probate deal and there's multiple errors. Long story short, this is like, I'm the expert here. I'm telling him to do this, but he was a seasoned entrepreneur, so he kind of wanted to do things his way. So what I learned with that is like, you don't really want to have too many cooks in the kitchen because then like everybody like has an opinion. And again, I didn't have my paperwork. He was the one on title, you know, and whatnot. So instead of making like $30,000 on that deal, I only made like $5,000. So those were two kind of consecutive deals where I was like, well, I'm never letting that happen again. If I'm going to partner with someone, then all of the paperwork needs to be aligned. It all needs to be protecting both of our interests because both of those relationships just went south and I never talked to those people again because like they screwed me out of money. And so I'm not going to do business with people that are not going to honor their word. So I think that was one of the things that I learned a lot. And guess what? This Maui house that I own with the partner, some of these other deals I've done have all turned out amazing because I learned from losing money on those other joint venture partnerships. So I failed forward on that, and that hasn't happened. And also, I do have students. I do mentor people. So whenever we potentially do deals together, like, all our paperwork is in order and everything's pretty clear. All the expectations are set and everything is protected, because I don't want relationships to go south because people don't do what they say they're going to do. And, you know, there's this saying that when it comes to money, people act funny. So
True.
Hey,
so do you structure everything now like 50-50?
No, not at all. It depends. There's so many ways you can structure it, but I think more so is I have everything laid out in paper, notarized. Everybody's kind of clear what's happening, and I don't move forward on deals unless everything, all the paperwork lines up of what we agreed upon.
Yeah, smart.
Yeah. Right now I don't really have to go 50-50 with anybody, because obviously, like, now I have a bigger track record. But I do give up equity. The deal I just bought in LA recently that has a potential profit of $100,000-$150,000 flip. I'm giving my guy 20%, and we're giving his guy 12% annualized rate. So he's getting 20% equity, and his guy's getting 12% for $200,000 that I needed for the gap funds on that deal. So I didn't put any money in the deal, but I'm still retaining about 70% of the profit. But that's based on my track record and based on me, you know, securing the deal and all of the above. So he's happy. He's learning about on the deal. His best friend is making a good return on the money that's just sitting there. And, you know, we structured that way, and all the paperwork reflects that exact scenario.
I like what you said there. I think the fact that you've got experience capital is something that gets overlooked a lot. There's a lot of times people just look at it. There's money, but having experience to actually operate and execute on a business plan, so that the person that's deploying the capital to you gets a good return out of it and they want to do it again. I think your experience capital gets better and better, and it gets a bigger worth out of the whole pie the more experience you get. So I love seeing the growth, man.
Exactly. So like when I worked for those investors, like I made very little money. They made the lion's share, but I was learning. So I think it's the how much are you learning to, like, what piece of the puzzle are you placing it? And I don't want to give up 50% of the equity at this point. Back then I needed to, and it worked out great. And it's not like I recommend that people not try to do that. I mean, I go 50-50 at times on certain scenarios, but the more the experience that you have, the less of the pie that you have to give up, because like, you can help execute that deal and make sure that all of us get paid, all the people part of the transaction get paid. Also, particularly too, when you're talking about people, partners that are passive, if you're putting up the money and, you know, that's, and I'm newer, then perhaps I do have to give up, you know, 50% of the equity of that deal. But if I'm experienced, I'm executing all the deal and you're just putting up the money, then like I don't want to give up 50% because like, I don't need to anymore. People offer me that all the time. Like, oh, hey, I'll partner with you. But like, hey, bro, I don't have to give you 50% because like I know someone else that will either lend me the money as debt. So there's really debt and equity, right? And when you're doing equity, well, you're giving up more. But there's also other risks. So it's like, if you're going to be equity, then you're with me on the upside, but you're also with me on the downside. So if we don't make money or we lose money on it, then you're going to share that risk with me too. So, you know, just I think deal structuring is very important and setting expectations is very important. But like you said, experience capital, I like that term. I think I'll copy that, use that sometime. But yeah, experience capital, you deserve more if you have a lot more experience because of your track record.
One thing I wanted to make sure we touched on was I know you got into coaching in the last that's a pretty recent thing for you. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm launching my paid coaching program this year. I've already been coaching within the Wealthy Investor program for almost 2 years now.
Oh, okay. Okay. And then so you have you want to maybe give us a plug on the new coaching program that you're coming up with?
Yeah, so I am going to be launching that this first quarter of 2024. We haven't figured out like kind of all the details of it, but people have been asking me for some time now, like, hey, you know, you do paid mentorship, or hey, will you coach me? But I've been so involved with doing deals and growing my brand and growing the meetups and all that I just really haven't wanted to do it. But now, you know, this is the time, because I feel like once we get past this, you know, issue with the AT unit, and then we've kind of survived through all of this, you know, all the changes in the market in the last like 18 months. And then we're still, you know, now we're positioned to thrive. And I still have, you know, I have a rental portfolio. I've done creative finance. I've done, you know, seller finance. I've done, you know, flipping and remotely, then wholesaling, all these things that I've done, you know, like I feel like I'm now really, you know, in the position to be able to coach someone through all these, you know, issues that I went through and all the learning that I've had, you know, again, you know, building the community, all the stuff that we've done, I feel like I'm in a position now to be able to help people. So yeah, we're going to be launching it this first quarter, and it'll likely be something like a you know, annual coaching or like a 6-month thing or something, you know, where it's an extended period of time, because I don't think people can, you know, figure out, you know, be coaching, like have success within a couple of months. It usually takes like a 6-month to a year to really like learn this business, or either help somebody get their first deal or help someone to be more consistent with doing deals. So I'm going to be predominantly working with newer or intermediate investors.
Well, good job. I'm sure you're going to put out some great content and a good program for people. So, well, Alex, we want to get you out of here. We've got one last section we'd like to go through where we ask the same questions of every guest.
We're almost out of time. Let's get into the OT with Owen and Ted.
We've got some questions for you. Are you ready for them?
Shoot.
All right. First one for you. What will your first book be titled or about?
Okay, so I thought about this book title a while ago, and it's gonna be like From Mayonnaise Sandwiches to Multimillionaire. Because, dude, when I was a kid, my family and I used to live in one of these like little Penske moving trucks for like the first year of us moving from Mexico. You know, or I mean, I was born here in California. But we lived in a moving truck for like the first year. And there were times we didn't even have enough money for like meat. So we would just eat like mayonnaise. I like mayonnaise, but we had mayonnaise sandwiches. So you know, for mayonnaise sandwiches, fellas, to multimillionaire, that would probably be it.
Oh, my God. That's great.
That'd be a story I'd read. I tell you that.
And it would just be my story. You know, my story of like, you know, growing up in an immigrant family and in a big metropolitan area of like L.A. and, you know, battling, you know, the poverty and battling potentially getting into bad, you know, bad things such as gangs and all that, and seeing friends get killed and all the things I've seen as a kid, and then but still find a way to like make it out of that environment, and then also like do something for my life, but also through the community I'm building, help other people elevate themselves too, because I recognize that my avatar, which is like essentially who I influence, right? I you know, I'm Latino. I'm 42, but I influence a lot of people in that community, the Latino community in Southern California. And that demographic is huge. So I want to help 10,000 Latinos in Southern California elevate themselves through using real estate investing as their vehicle. So I think it will just kind of be an inspirational story of you know, how I've been able to kind of overcome things and also make an impact.
You know, I helped get a Latino RIA group going here in Omaha. And it's all Spanish speaking. A great guy named Jose Pena runs it, and love to connect you guys. And maybe they can get you to speak sometime, even virtually. They have a very good group, and it's been going for about a year now.
Awesome, bro. Yeah, I'd love to.
It'd mean a lot to them. I know that.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Alex, first, before I ask this question, do you have your own podcast?
Not currently. We want to do it, but no, not currently.
Okay, so we're on the Alex podcast, and you can interview anyone in the world today that's alive. Who's the person you want to interview, and what's the one question you want to ask?
Ooh, I love Elon Musk. I think he's just one of those people that have just made a tremendous impact on the world. And so I think I'd want to ask him really, 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 like, what is his, like, day-to-day look like? Because it's just – I wonder what kind of meetings he's having with all the technology he's working on, and I know he works a lot of hours. He's been very vocal about that, about sleeping on the showroom floor of Tesla and all these things like that. But I think I just have a tremendous amount of respect for him and his mind, how he thinks. And I just want to ask him, like, you know, and peek into like his day to day and like shadow him for a day, or could I shadow him for a day or something like that, just to see the type of conversations he's having and how he's leading his team to all the things that he's doing.
You have arrived at the time in your life where you have done your last deal, and we're at your funeral. Who is going to be giving your eulogy, and what do you hope they'll say about you?
Wow. So I think maybe I don't have him or her now, but I think it would be somebody that I've been influenced greatly. Maybe one of my proteges, maybe, you know, somebody that is someone that I've taught and mentored that really helped change their life. And I think they would be just talking about, you know, who I was, how I was, what my energy was like, and what, you know, kind of impact that I had on them. And then also what impact they've been able to have on other people because of my impact to them.
I love it. Yeah. Great answer.
Alex, what mentor in your life has had the biggest impact on you and how they influenced your career or personal growth?
Yeah, that was easy. So I'd say it's a Brandon Turner from, you know, the Bigger Pockets, now the Better Life podcast. I just resonated with his energy, his way of being very relatable. And I listened to him for years, and it's just remarkable. I still don't believe it sometimes. Like he's my friend. Like, he turned from like an idol to a mentor, to a friend, to a neighbor, you know, in Hawaii. And just seeing how he treats people, how he treats his wife, but in person, and just being, you know, he works a lot, but he loves what he does so much that he just makes it look effortless. And he taught me a lot of how to like have an intern, and the intern model that he has is something that I remixed and I do often too, because I saw it firsthand when I moved to Hawaii. I was actually living at his finance manager's house hack, and that house hack was a triplex. So one of the units was just full of interns. It was like two interns and the finance manager and me. And so I just got to see kind of the inside of how he would treat them, you know, what he would have them do for him. And they were like, they weren't making very much money, but they were so happy and they were so engaged. They were so excited every day to go work with him. I just thought to myself, like, I would love to, you know, help other people like that and have people that really are my ride or dies. You know, they want to work with me. They're excited to come to battle with me every day. And so I've done that myself, you know, often. And so I think just being able to improve my leadership, because I'm not a natural leader. Like, I'm a hustler, you know. I grew up just being very ambitious, but I can't say that leadership was something that I strived for. But after seeing him and his leadership style, because I think every leader has some things in common, but like they all have their own voice, their own way of leading. And so I feel like he influenced me a lot of taking that step forward and saying, you know, I'm going to be a leader. I'm going to have my own voice. I have my own style, and that's okay. It doesn't have to be like everybody else's. I could do it, you know, in my own way. And so all these little nuances that I learned from him, and I still learn from him. I still follow this stuff, and we still interact, and I've attended a lot of his masterminds. But he also inspired me to create my own, you know, my own mastermind, my own community, and just really make a big impact, but do it in a cool, fun way too. So I think that that's my answer to that.
Because of Megan Ahern, we were blessed to actually have 3 hours with him in his house when he was in San Diego for BPCon to do an in-person podcast. And the one thing that the one thing I came out of it personally was like, hey, this guy is who he actually, you know, the guy that he portrays, he really is. And exactly. Just very kind and family oriented. Kids were around us playing, you know, his wife came down and said hi. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's very real and just super genuine is what I guess the best way I could put that.
Yeah, agreed. I felt the same way every time I've been interacting with him. Same thing, yeah.
And then he put us in headlocks.
Yeah, he's showing off his Brazilian jiu-jitsu skills.
He's quite jovial. He's definitely a jokester. You know, I like that about him too.
Yeah.
Denlis.
Hey, Alex. This was so good, bro. So good. Like, I can't wait to edit this. This is going to be such a good podcast. But when you were a little Camacho Chito,
I like it.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Dude, I think it's crazy because I for a little bit of time, I really wanted to be an astronaut. It was crazy. Like, and there's this like movie called, I think, A Million Miles Away. That came out, I think, on Amazon Prime. I watched it about this immigrant that became an astronaut, from an immigrant family. So I think that was kind of like crazy to me. I don't know why. For like, I think a year or two when I was younger, I was like, man, I want to be an astronaut. I want to go into space. That went away, but that was the first thing I could remember like wanting to actually be. And then I was confused for a real long time after that because that's not going to happen.
Well, Alex, this has been awesome. What is the best way, since you're a social media titan now and have reestablished your stolen Instagram account, what's the best way for somebody catching this episode to reach out to you? And is there anything you're looking for in your business where, you know, somebody might be able to put you in touch with the right person?
Yeah, of course. So the easiest way to get in touch with me, I have a social media manager helps me. So we respond to all of our DMs. A lot of the DMs I respond to myself. So just shoot me a DM on Alex Camacho TV. That's my primary account. If they're Latinos, they could, I'm going to switch the other account. That's the Alex Camacho. Currently, I'm going to switch that to maybe El Alex Camacho. So, that's going to be all Spanish speaking there. And just, you know, Instagram, they could hit me there. And then as far as like just my markets, if they're in Southern California or they're, you know, in Hawaii or Phoenix and, you know, they want to reach out and we could talk about some deal flow. I'm always looking for, you know, capital partners. I'm always looking for deals. So any of that, I mean, feel free to reach out.
I tell you what, Alex, I first met you at BPCon and it was because Megan Ahern said, hey, you got to meet Alex. She ran it and raved on how kind you were and how awesome you are and what everything that you're doing. We approached you for a quick interview later on during that event, and you're like, hey, yeah, no problem, let's go do it. And then reached out to you about the podcast. You responded immediately, and I just tell you what, it just tells you what kind of person you are. So, you know, I appreciate you. I appreciate your openness. And I appreciate you getting vulnerable and telling about your story. And I love what you're doing. And I can't wait to get to know you better and seeing everything that you're doing over the next couple of years. So
thank you, Ted. Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Dennis. I appreciate you guys. I mean, you know, I love sharing my story. I think this every one of these is like different. And this is like a different format. And/or you guys are, you know, really intelligent, asking some real thoughtful questions. And I always appreciate that because also these allow me to remember some of the things I've learned from all the things that I've done. I'm very auditory learner. So when I'm talking to people, and that's why I like coaching, I like teaching people things because like it allows me to just really ingrain the principles, the lessons, all the things that I've been through in this game. Actually, this past week, we were in a mastermind circle at the Wealthy Investor thing. And it was just for like the all-star students. And we're in the circle of like, I think it was like 20 people. And I kind of quickly became almost like the moderator and the one kind of the most vocal and the one kind of probing because I've been in so many of these masterminds. It's not always about me telling this person what they should do. A lot of times it's just me asking that person more questions, probing that challenge they're going through. And so I derived so much energy from that because I'm like, okay, this person now is going to figure out this big challenge of theirs. Just, and it wasn't me telling them something. They knew what they had to do. They just had to be asked and probe the right questions or some more questions to kind of peel the layer of the onion. And so I really enjoy stuff like this because it'll help someone else, hopefully. And then it's helping me because it's helping me remember all the cool stuff and all the lessons. And then obviously it's building a connection between us here. And I'm sure you guys are going to be around and we'll see each other in some circles. And I'm sure we'll be either having a drink or grabbing a bite to eat at one of these conferences and just going deep and see what you guys are up to because you guys are action takers. So I love being around, you know, other people that are doing stuff, but also helping elevate more and more people through this real estate investing because you do this business right and there's no limit to your potential. Like I've seen people that own, you know, a lot of real estate are just complete a-holes. And I've seen other people that are like the Brandon Turners that, I mean, are going to be a billionaire probably and is still a wonderful person at heart. And so just because, you know, I've had certain level of success doesn't mean that like I have to turn into an asshole or anything like that, or I have to be someone different. Like I want to be enthusiastic of what I'm working on and I want to help other people. But, you know, some people just don't have that same energy, dude. And so I really feel that from you guys, that you guys generally are good people, you know, great investors. And so any way that I can help, you know, I got your back, hit me up, let's stay in touch. And, you know, we'll just have a monster 2024, much better than 2023.
Yeah, right?
Well, Owen, you want to see us out, buddy?
On behalf of Dennis Bertrand, Rhea Radio, and Ted Kosh, I'm Owen Dashner, and you've been listening to Alex from Moving Trucks and Mayonnaise Sandwiches to Multimillionaire Camacho. Signing off.
Let's go.